Hi, everybody. Okay, it's another beautiful day in Redmond, Washington, and I am in an office here, and now my back is up against the wall, and I'm just going to pan around the room and have everybody in the office introduce themselves, beginning with you, sir. Who are you?
My name is Jensen Harris, and I'm the group program manager of the Office User Experience Team. So we're the team that designed and built the new user interface that's part of Office 2007.
So like the ribbon and stuff like that?
The ribbon and galleries and you know, all the UI that we did in Word, Excel, PowerPoint, Outlook, and Access.
Okay, very cool. And actually, before I move on, you said a GPM, a group
program manager. Yes.
Okay, now I've been working really hard to try to get all the acronyms, you know, kind of fleshed out here for the Niners, because I work here and I don't even know what they mean. So, what's a group program manager? I've met a lot of pooms now, but I don't know what a gpm is.
Poom. Yeah. So a GPM isn't quite as good as a poom.
Oh.
So my job basically is to manage the program management team. So I have a couple lead PMs and then about a dozen PMs that work on my team, and we, you know, come up with the specs and the designs and work with customers, and you know, my job, I really look at my job as sort of helping with the 10% hardest problems that we have on the team, and also sort of putting the pieces together. Like, we have brilliant UI folks on the team who, you know, can work on an individual problem and figure out the best solution for that. And I sort of look at my job as sort of helping to make sure all the pieces fit together and, you know, jump in where I can to help with problems that are really hard and really hard time problems. So to the extent that we have sort of an architect role in terms of program management, I would say that's been most of what my role has been over the last product cycle.
Okay, very cool. So I'm going to swivel around here, and we will get you, sir, there at the far end of the couch. I mean, you're familiar to Channel 9, of course, but, you know, just for kicks.
So I'm Jeremy Masner, and I'm an evangelist, and also a Channel 9 interviewer when I get roped into it.
All right. And then over here on the couch is special guest today.
My name's Judy Jennison. I'm the Associate General Counsel for the Office Business. So I'm
Does that mean lawyer?
Yeah.
Lawyer. Okay.
Yeah,
all right.
That's true.
Am I being arrested?
We'll see.
She's only half kidding. It sounds like that's cool. Okay, so should we go to GPM? We've got an evangelist and we got a lawyer in the room. And someone with the camera. So where do we want to start here?
So let's start about with the announcement that by the time this video is available, it should be a fairly recent announcement. And let's talk about what we're announcing.
Yeah. So today is April 2nd, 2005. I don't know. It's actually true. So we have, as those of you who have sort of followed along on the web, the sort of progress of Office 2007, we've put a really substantial investment in improving the usability of Office, in, you know, making it easy to use and designing a UI that really sort of unlocks the soul of Word and Excel and Outlook and PowerPoint. And today, we're announcing that partners and software developers around the world can license the user interface of Office 2007 for use within their own programs. And so you can use things like the ribbon and galleries and the visual appearance of Office within your own program to make it easier to use and to make it consistent with Office. And we're providing a set of design guidelines that help you be consistent with Office, because we know from the research that we've done on the UI that certain things are successful and certain things are sort of usability problems. And so we really want to help people in the industry take advantage of the research that we've done and take advantage of our user interface in a way that sort of gets the best of it without falling into all the pitfalls that we did along the way. And so the design guidelines are there to make it possible to license, you know, the work that we've put into the UI for your own program. And we'll have both, like, software vendors who are writing their own programs who will use the UI, and ISVs who will build controls so that, you know, you can have a Visual Basic or a C# WinForms app and drag a ribbon directly into your form and use something that looks and feels as near as possible to the Office UI directly in an app that has nothing to do with Office and isn't made at Microsoft. So to the extent that we envisioned the UI, the Office UI, as sort of the next thing beyond menus and toolbars, right? I mean, that's really what we started with, was menus and toolbars have been around for 20 years, since the mid-70s, and we wanted to come up with something that sort of transcends the problems that people had with menus and toolbars, usability problems. But menus and toolbars are ubiquitous, right? Like, every program has a menu almost today. And so we thought it was important that we can attain that same level of ubiquitousness with the ribbon and with galleries and with the other great things that we've done in Office 2007. And so I'm really excited finally to be able to tell people how they can use the UI and that they can use the UI in their own programs.
So you think it's just a little bit of Microsoft, you know, hubris that we think other people would even want to use the stuff? What leads you to believe that there are developers who are interested in having the same look as...
Well, I would say, you know, probably the number one reason is because it's been the most prominent question I've been asked over the last 3 years. Again and again and again, people have written to me, have gone on my blog and posted comments, and in some cases have just gone out and started figuring out how to clone the UI. So we know that there's a tremendous amount of interest in it. And I think one of the reasons is because we've been really open, like online, about blogging about the research behind the UI and sort of not just dumping a product on people, but actually showing them the things we screwed up along the way and explaining how we were going to fix it and sort of the whole process of design that I think have led a bunch of people to come to the same conclusions we have about how well the UI works because they've seen the ideas behind it. And honestly, the problems that we were struggling with in previous versions of Word, for instance, with people finding features in Word, same problems that many of the people in our industry are having with their programs. They've become simply more feature-rich than menus and toolbars were ever designed to support. I mean, the drop-down menu was something that was invented really at Xerox PARC in the 1970s when an average menu had like five things on it. Today, a program like Word has 1,500 commands. And there are other programs out there in the world that similarly are a lot more feature-rich than anything was 20 years ago. And so we think of the ribbon as being the paradigm that can sort of bring your app back in control. And certainly the interest that we've gotten from people has been very substantial.
Yeah. Rory,
can I ask you a question? Yeah, I raised my hand. So when you say that, it makes me wonder, you know, for the people who didn't follow the entire story, right, you know, you're talking about help and you were about blogging it. Was it really, really, since you're so used to, I mean, we're also used to menus and toolbars, right, that to try to conceptualize something, you know, outside that is almost like trying to imagine like a new color or a new, you know, like a new sense or something. I mean, we're so used to it and so grounded in that. Was it really tough trying to come up with a major control like the ribbon, you know, to replace tools and menu bars? And how many designs did you throw out? How many times did you go back to the drawing board to refigure this out?
Well, we threw out many, 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 many months' worth of designs.
Mm-hmm.
So it isn't hard to come up with an idea that's not menus and toolbars. It's pretty easy to come up with an idea. It's really hard to come up with an idea that actually is better than menus and toolbars. I mean, the guys that figured out how the graphical user interface should work back in the 1970s and early 80s were geniuses.
So you think they did a really good job that actually stood the test of time for several decades?
Yeah, I mean, that's amazing, right? Like, they designed something that lasted in the computer world for two decades. Think about what computers were like two decades ago. Think about how much technology has changed in less. That's like 8 tracks. If we were still listening to 8 tracks today because the things that they came up with were so great 20 years ago.
Hmm.
So I give them all the credit in the world. The hard thing is coming up with something that's a worthy successor to menus and toolbars. So the reason that I think we were always confident, though, that we would eventually find the thing that had the qualities we were looking for was that for the last 5 to 7 years, we've actually been drastically overestimating how well menus and toolbars work just because of familiarity.
I noticed that, you know, the first step was to do the partially hidden menu.
Yeah.
Right, you know, and then show the entire menu if it's decided that you want to get to the advanced functionality. But was that just sort of a stopgap measure before you got to this point? Or?
Well, I'm not a big fan of the IntelliMenus, and
that's what they're called.
Yeah, or personalized menus. Mm-hmm. I think might be the actual name. I think if you actually go into the dialogue, it's called Always Show Full Menus. Well,
we've got a lawyer here. You don't want to mess up on the nomenclature. So.
I see. I think here's the difference. IntelliMenus were designed to reduce the perception of bloat, which is to say that they make the program seem like it has fewer menu items by hiding half of the menu items from you. But what happens when you need something that just got hidden from you? Well, now it's twice as hard to find it because you have to scan down the menu, and then if it's not there, click a little thing, and then the menu opens up again, but it doesn't just open up below the part you looked at before. They open up all over the place, intermingled with the other menu items. So you have to rescan the entire thing. So you have to, in a sense, scan the menu 1.5 times every time to find the thing that you're looking for. So it was sort of a stopgap measure, I think, because there was the sense that until we knew what the right thing was to do, that we shouldn't change things too much. And so the Office UI stayed very similar for many, many years. In fact, Word 2.0 was designed before the Berlin Wall came down, and the top-level menu and toolbar structure was exactly the same then as it is now. File edit, view, format, tools, table, window, help. That was true in 1989, and it's true in 2006. And so the ribbon was the first time that we really had something that we knew was right, that we'd done the research behind it, and that... And one of the reasons that I think we had more confidence that it was possible to come up with something is, you mentioned how ubiquitous menus and toolbars are, but you don't really see menus and toolbars that much on Amazon.com or on YouTube or on Flickr or, you know, the websites that people use out there. People have become more used to thinking about things outside of the framework of just menus and toolbars. And so we knew if we could come up with something that was truly better, that we were confident that people would follow, that the people would recognize it, even though they're so familiar with menus and toolbars.
So let's talk a little bit more about the specific notions behind this license. I think maybe Judy will bring you in now and get to have the lawyer speak. In the past, I've seen as an evangelist, as iterations of Office came out, Office XP, Office 2003, we did, in fact, see sort of software developers want to snap to that Office look and feel. And, you know, I think in contrast to this time when there's so much real innovation around it, I think it was less about functionality, more about people saying, we just want to look like the standard, right? We want our users to be familiar with whatever. If they all get trained on Office, then we want our app to be easy to get trained on also. And so, you know, people generally did that. We had support in Visual Studio Whidbey for making an app that looks... has the similar, you know, layout to the Office 2003 menu items. So we're taking a different approach this time around. And it sounds like the goal is the same. We still want applications and our software developers to be able to take advantage of our work and be part of the Office paradigm. But why the different approach this time?
Well, I think there are two reasons. The primary reason from a lawyer's perspective is that there are some intellectual property rights that we can only protect by controlling their use. And so rather than giving the rights away, we wanted to make them available in a way that that was beneficial for our partners, but also that meant we didn't have to compete against our own intellectual property for the core Office app. So that was, one is protecting the intellectual property. And one of the others is that we did often get questions from folks before, hey, you know, when you see other people are creating applications that look like Office, will you grant us affirmative rights so we know it's okay for us to do that? And historically, we didn't. We just sort of let folks go off and do what they wanted to do. This way, we are affirmatively granting rights to our partners, so they know exactly where they stand, and we can help them create better applications because we're giving them the guidelines to do that.
Yep. All right, so let me ask you, this is a sort of devil's advocate question. Why do you even care about protecting intellectual property? If that's sort of at the root of it. Is that an evil thing to do?
There's nothing evil about protecting intellectual property at all. I mean, we're a software company. This is all about intellectual property. There is hundreds of millions of innovation that went into developing the new user interface. You've heard Jensen talk about the work that went into it. It just went on for years. It's tremendous innovation. And we've invested that kind of money in it. We shouldn't, the whole world shouldn't be able to use it. We're being very generous, I think, by letting folks use it in a royalty-free program. We haven't mentioned that yet.
No,
in this conversation, the program's royalty-free. So we're not trying to extort money from folks to do it. We just want everybody to follow the guidelines and follow the rules.
Can I ask a question of the lawyer?
Sure.
Well, I don't get any opportunities, you know. So,
that's probably good for you.
I've always been curious about this, you know. I get the feeling some people are going to see this, you know, and they're going to think, oh, man, you know, Microsoft lawyer, that's all they're going to see, right? And they're going to think, oh, IP rights, they're just trying to, you know, it's the man, they're trying to keep us down, you know, blah, 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 blah. But in a way, isn't, I mean, we're saying go ahead and use this stuff. This is just to protect ourselves to some extent, isn't it? I mean, if we didn't take this and make it our own IP, then somebody else could go out, do the ribbon, copyright it, and then nail us. Isn't that possible?
Well,
or is there a prior art sort of?
You're failing law school already.
there are a lot of different nuances. So I think that the simplest answer to your question is probably not,
mm-hmm.
Because I think it's well documented that we got out there first.
Yeah.
But there are a couple of things. It protects our ability to control the intellectual property. It also preserves the value not just for us, but for our licensees as well. Because the other folks who are following the guidelines know that they're creating applications that are compliant. It means that folks who are using the ribbon paradigm the same way that we do will all be doing it in a consistent fashion in accordance with the guidelines. So it maintains a higher quality of user interface and a higher quality of application for everybody. If we had a lot of folks who were out there taking bits and pieces of it but really not following the guidelines, in other words, using our IP without our permission, then we'd have an ecosystem where the paradigm stopped being as rich and as useful as it will be with all the consistency.
Hmm. So the goal, if we're looking 5 years out, is to hopefully have a whole ecosystem of applications that behave in a similar, consistent way using the ribbon paradigm and galleries for whatever is most suitable for their application.
And I think one of the most brilliant documents ever created is the Apple Human Interface Guidelines. And what the Human Interface Guidelines say is, here's a simple recipe for how to use the controls that Apple provides in a consistent way. And if everyone does things the same way, it's that much easier for the user. Because as the user moves from program to program to program, things work the way that they expect. And so part of it, from our perspective, is we don't want to see people take the ideas that we came up with and then change them into something that doesn't work, and that reflects badly on Office, frankly, because they say, well, this thing has the Office UI and it doesn't work very well. That must mean the Office 2007 doesn't work that well. And so I think we're just trying to take a cue from, you know, the value of guidelines and the value of having guidelines and sort of enforcing consistency. And this is something that Windows does, too. For the controls that ship in Windows, they have not a license program, but they do have guidelines documents around that. And so, you know, we're the folks that are the first people to come up with the ribbon and the paradigm and galleries and all the other things that we've built into the system, which is the user interface. And so all the things Judy said are absolutely true about us wanting to, you know, protect the IP and things like that. But from the team's perspective, like from my guys, we would love to see people use it. I mean, we worked so hard on this user interface. We worked so hard on figuring out how this thing should work that nothing would delight us more than to see it show up in a lot of different places and to see it help solve some of the usability problems people are having in building software programs. So the guidelines, for me, are the heart of it, because that's the thing that can help ensure that people make the paradigm switch the right way.
Yep. All right, so in the old world, in the Office 2003 time frame, if you wanted to sort of leverage Microsoft's work there and you wanted to sort of bring the same experience to your application, you basically kind of sat down and you played with the Office apps and you tried to see what the features were of the UI and what happens when you drag the toolbar and what happens when you switch to high resolution or when you switch to a foreign language or something like that. And then you'd have to just start from scratch and build it up. So in the new world, where we have the guidelines and this license, how does a developer get started? What's the very first step?
For very first step is buy Office 2007, buy one for everyone who's going to be working on the project, and sit down with it and do exactly that. Like, in the end, you're never going to do better than a close observation of the program and copy every little behavior that we have. That said, that's not always something that people have the time to do, and we have created a guidelines document that tries to document as much as we can about the best practices for each of the controls of the user interface, and a set of requirements that say, if you're going to implement the mini toolbar, which is this cool little thing when you hover over text, you get a little toolbar that lets you do formatting, right, sort of on object.
You get that, or should we do it again?
Let's see the mini toolbar there.
Let's do that again. So let's pick some text in the middle of the Word document. Let's say I want to make this text bigger. So I can select it and let go of the mouse, and this little ghosted toolbar shows up above my mouse.
Okay, so right there. I got it, yeah.
As I move closer to it, I can then use the controls here. I can bold or italic it. And then as I move away, it just goes away. That thing's called the mini toolbar. If you want to use the mini toolbar in your app, and it's great for certain kinds of on-object formatting, then you can do it. But it needs to work in a consistent way to how the one in Office works. It needs to fade in the same way. It needs to look similar. It needs to do the same thing when you click it. And so the guidelines are there. You could just look at the program and reverse sort of engineer by looking at it, you know, what its behaviors are. But the guideline document's there to help you do the right thing. And so that's sort of the answer to, like, how would you start from that perspective? If the question is, how do you get started, you know, with the license, if you want to acquire the royalty-free license, Judy would probably know better than I would the answer to that.
Yeah, we've tried to make the process as easy as we can make it. It's a very simple click-through agreement, web agreement. It's two pages, plain language, so it's not full of legalese, and it's not something you have to hire a team of lawyers to help you negotiate. It's really pretty simple. There's a very short one-page evaluation license if you want to take a look at the guidelines so that you can decide whether the guidelines really are right for you and whether the license is right. That's also a click-through on the web. You can download the guidelines, take a look at them. If you decide that you do want to get the license, come back. You click through the license agreement. You can download a permanent copy of the guidelines and then register with us the products that you want to use the UI for, and that's it.
This is actually the guidelines document that I have up here. It's currently 129 pages. I think we're almost done with it, but a lot of them are pictures. So this doesn't count as a whole page of whole page.
Yeah, it's wide margins too.
But we tried to be like, yeah, extremely prescriptive about like actually showing you how the things work, and you know, showing you the bitmaps that can be used for different parts of you know, showing selection and things like that. So you know, it's a lot of pages, and it may seem fairly dense, but a lot of it is just pictures that help to illustrate, you know, different concepts, and really trying to sort of walk you through, you know, exactly what people used to do, which was just sit down and play with it, sort of figure out how it works.
Yep. So it sounds like there are maybe two licenses we should just talk about quickly. So the first one, you said the evaluation license, is that right?
Yeah.
So that's if you want to just look at this document, the design guidelines document, and what is the point of that license?
Essentially, it's protecting the confidentiality of the design document, that you're using it only for evaluation purposes, just to take a look at it, rather than freely letting everybody distribute the guidelines around so that people will just kind of rip off the guidelines anyway without agreeing to the license terms. That's what we're trying to prevent.
Okay.
But at the same time, we knew people would want to take a look at the guidelines before they signed the license, so we just wanted to provide an easy way for them to be able to do that.
So what if you can summarize, maybe this is dangerous to do, is to summarize the license without having the whole license, but basically the terms of the license, just to look at the design guidelines.
Yeah, it just says that we're providing them for purposes of evaluation only, so they can only be used for evaluation, that they are confidential and can't be redistributed without Microsoft's written permission.
All right, and then you can read it to your heart's content.
Yeah.
Look at it.
Yeah.
And then so the next step then would be a developer looks at it, says, I would like the design guidelines. Maybe my app should look like that. What's the next step?
Next step is come back to the website and click to look at the legal agreement. People can look at the legal agreement before they sign it. So, you know, they can print it out. They can walk it around their company, show it to their lawyers if they want to. And then when they're ready to agree to the terms of the agreement, just click through to accept it. And then they get to download a version of the guidelines that has the full license in it so that they'll know it's not just a for review only copy. It's mm-hmm. the real copy of the guidelines. And then they can register their products on the website and take it from there.
All right. And what are, again, if it's possible to summarize mm-hmm. roughly what that second license looks like? So what is it asking of people or requiring them to do? So we said no money.
There's no money, okay. So it's royalty free. There are no platform restrictions, so that's an important point. It's not for the Windows platform only. It's for any platform. The only two major restrictions really are that you have to follow the guidelines if you're a licensee, so you can't pick and choose what you're going to implement and not implement. And the other is that the license is not available for applications that have the same primary functionality as the five applications that currently have the ribbon in Office. That's Word, Excel, PowerPoint, Outlook, and Access. So that was the one restriction. Our one carve-out was we want to preserve the innovation in the user interface for the space of these five applications that Microsoft is already using it for.
So if you're building another mail client, you can't look like the Outlook 2007 mail client.
Correct.
Right. So it seems reasonable. I mean, if that's...
Well, it seems reasonable to me.
I think, in terms of actually getting started technically, one of the things that we'll probably suggest to people is when they have decided that this license and the UI is right for their program, to look at one of the many ISVs that are going to be providing Office UI that is, in a sense, already compliant. Like, there are some ISVs that are doing an amazing job of working to, follow the guidelines and build UI that follows those guidelines. And so I think the easiest path to having a program that supports the guidelines is probably going to be to buy a control that has those guidelines.
I was going to mention that. We have a number of control vendors who have signed up with us as early adopters. So they have licensed the UI, and they've had the guidelines for a while, and in fact worked with us to finalize the guidelines and to finalize the terms of the license, too.
Yeah, and we would suggest selecting your control vendor based on the one that adheres to the guidelines most closely. I mean, that's something that we want to see is a ecosystem of controls that really do a great job of feeling and looking and acting like Office, because that's going to benefit everyone, that you're not going to have to learn two or three slightly different things out there. And that's going to be the easiest way for people to, get a ribbon drug into their WinForm and get started programming.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So we have a list of the component vendors who are in the program somewhere?
We haven't decided yet whether we were going to publish a list on the website, because since folks can sign up pretty easily through the web, that list is likely to change very quickly.
Okay.
So I don't know yet whether we're going to do that, but certainly if anyone had questions about whether a component vendor was licensed or not, they could ping the alias for questions and we can answer that.
Okay. What's the alias? All right, so we don't know yet, or you have to go through the website?
I knew what it was once. I don't have it
right
at top of mind right now. So
we'll put it in the
we can bleep it in.
Yeah, we can. We can.
You just move your mouth a little bit, and then we can put it in.
Yeah.
Perfect. And then the last thing I was going to say is, what would you say to someone who looked at the license terms and said, "Well, I don't know about those. I don't feel comfortable, or my legal team has issues with them." Is there any room for flexibility, or is it sort of take it or leave it?
Well, I guess there's a little room for flexibility, but it's a royalty-free program, like I said before, hundreds of millions in innovation, and we are really, we're not looking for protracted negotiations. We feel we've been really, really generous. Like I said, we've talked about the license terms with a number of early adopters to make sure that they were comfortable with the terms. We've had lots of folks sign on already. Today we've had, I think, 15 or 16 people have already signed up to the standard terms. So we're really not looking for a lot of negotiation. But that said, if somebody's got a particular issue with it for some reason and wants to contact us, we'd certainly be happy to talk to them about it.
So maybe should we talk about the guidelines? One set of requirements was sort of encapsulated in that license, and we talked about the certain products that can and can't use it. And the other big requirement you mentioned was complying with the guidelines. So Should we talk about the guidelines?
Yeah, sure.
How easy is it to comply with the guidelines? Is it?
So what we've tried to do, so one of the things you'll see when you browse through the document is that we've sort of broken things up into three sections. One is a section of required components to the UI, and so it's only two. There's required and there's optional. So if you implement any of the required things, like for instance, the ribbon, if you do the ribbon, then you have to do the keyboard model for the ribbon as well. You can't decide to do the ribbon but only make it work with the mouse. So, and then there's a set of optional components, like the mini toolbar, that hope that's an optional component. I think it is. I think it should be. Which, if you choose to use it, then you have to follow the guidelines for it. But you could choose to say, you know, the mini toolbar doesn't make sense for the program that I'm building. Then within each section, like the ribbon section, you know, how do you develop the ribbon? Then there are three parts. There are musts, which are things that you must do in order to be in compliance with the license. And then there are optional pieces that we think that you should do, and Office does, and would make you more consistent, but we're not going to make you do it to be in compliance with license. And then we've tried to put in best practices, which are just, hey, these would help improve the usability of your program based on what we know about this part of the UI. And so what we've tried to do is have as few musts as possible to make it easy to implement, while having the right number of musts to make sure that the experience stays consistent. So, you know, a good example is, so let's move to, App like PowerPoint. Okay, so one of the things that the ribbon has is the ability to scale the UI down based on the size of your screen. So if you look here, you'll see as I shrink it down, it can sort of collapse itself to...
The icons get smaller.
The icons get smaller, and eventually it disappears entirely. And then, you know, conversely, as you get bigger, you know, and especially on a tab like this, you can see that it can expand all the way to take up the entire 1600 by 1200 monitor. If you're going to do the ribbon, then you have to do ribbon scaling. You have to make it scale down. Now, you don't have to do it 100% as fancy as we did it, although we think that would be the best, and we've documented that. But you have to have a way for it to get smaller. You can't simply put in scroll bars and say, well, you know, we didn't want to build the part of it which makes it, you know, sort of condense, but we'll let you scroll back and forth. The reason why is because we know from, you know, because we tried that idea 3 years ago, because that was easier than scaling, and it makes the ribbon a very bad experience.
Driving nuts.
Because, you have to scroll left, scroll right, scroll left, and every tab you have to go back and forth. So we would make that a must, because in order to sort of preserve the usability characteristics of the ribbon, you have to do scaling. Other things we've made optional because, you know, it wouldn't be the end of the world if you didn't do them, but again, we hope that that a lot of component vendors and a lot of people will do everything in the list, because that will give you the most consistent experience with Office.
How closely do design guidelines look like the spec that the developers used to build? Well, it's the two side, which came first, even maybe? Huh?
It's interesting because the specs came first, and you know, the specs are in a little bit more detail. I think the original ribbon spec, which is actually written in three parts, we had three development milestones in Office 12. A dev milestone is like a, you know, 10 or 12 or 16 weeks of time where you build a set of features. We wrote ribbon in all three milestones. So we had a ribbon milestone 1 spec, then a ribbon milestone 2 spec, and ribbon milestone 3 spec. I think in total that probably equaled 200 pages just for the ribbon in terms of the spec. So the design guidelines aren't quite as detailed as the spec, but as detailed as they ended up being, we definitely have asked ourselves in recent weeks, maybe it would have been easier to start with the spec as opposed to rewriting them from scratch. So in a sense, what we did was Rich Grutzmacher, who's a PM on my team, has for the last 2 months sort of reverse-engineered the UI. He's gone back and said, okay, now that it's done, let's write down everything that we did. Like, what would be the spec now that it's finished in the sort of most compact, most beautiful way? And he's gone and collected feedback from all the people who actually designed the features on our team. The person who wrote the ribbon spec, the person who wrote the gallery spec, the person who wrote the mini toolbar spec. We've reviewed it again and again to make sure that it is, you know, it really captures the sort of soul of the user interface. So it's much shorter than the spec, but you can read it like a spec. I like to think that it's better than the spec because we know sort of how it turned out, in a sense. We know exactly what it looks like when we're done, and so we can write the spec a lot better than we could 3 years ago when we were still sort of feeling our way around. Like, if you looked at the Ribbon M1 spec today, there'd be whole parts of it you'd sort of laugh at and say, this doesn't look anything like what you guys ship, because we learned as we went, and we iterated so much on the product as we went that whole pieces of it got taken out and whole other pieces got added, you know, in its place.
All right. Well, maybe just to wrap up, let's do you get a preemptive chance to address the rudest questions that are going to come in from the Channel 9 audience or from the developer world. So each of you pick what you think the most obnoxious or rudest question is going to be and answer it to get it out of the way.
Well, I guess I wouldn't call this the rudest question, but I think a very good question that people may ask is the license available for open source implementations? And the answer is yes. There's nothing in the license that's inconsistent with software that's open sourced. There may be particular open source licenses that are not consistent with our licenses and some of the terms that we have. So each developer needs to determine whether their license scheme is appropriate or not. But there's no exclusion for open source implementations.
One of the things that we heard from the some of the early adopters was, how free are we within the license to change elements of the UI, to adapt them for our own program? Like, we sort of like some of the parts of the ribbon, but we want to turn it into the bow tie or some, you know, totally different thing that's sort of based on that, and, you know, we should be allowed to do that because we've always done it in the past, because, you know, we essentially didn't monitor what people were doing at all with, like, the Office 2003 UI. I think the answer there goes back to sort of what's best for the overall ecosystem, which is, if we end up with a large number of user experiences that sort of trick you into thinking that they work the same, but then once you get into them, they don't at all, then the whole system falls down. I mean, the reason that drop-down menus worked so well for so long, because people implemented them consistently, that you click on them and something comes down, and, you know, eventually people added things to them. Like, eventually, I think, you know, Microsoft led the way to putting icons next to things on menus. Then people started to copy that. Eventually, we did the personalized IntelliMenus that we talked about earlier. And eventually, people copied that in a consistent way. So I think the important thing is that we keep things consistent. And where there's room for innovation within the system, we should, you know, continue looking at that. Like, you know, we should look at how this UI should get taken to the next step so that it's, you know, 10 and 20 years down the road, it's still something that is viable. But that's something that needs to happen consistently and needs to happen, you know, starting with us, starting with, you know, the people who worked on it, you know, originally, because that is intellectual property that we do own. So it's not at all that we want to stifle innovation. What we want to do is espouse consistency and sort of looking out for everyone, not just for, you know, our programs or looking out for any individual program. And so again, like in the spirit of human interface guidelines, I mean, that's the best thing for everyone, to have programs work the same way. And so that's really, I think, the core of this.
Well, that's, I'll ask one last group question, which is, you know, you ask developers to think about signing a license agreement or sort of clicking through a license agreement. Maybe sometimes they wonder, well, you know, what happens if something goes wrong or I didn't quite follow the guidelines right? They're going to get a call from you or a visit. You're going to show up at someone's door one day and knock and put them in handcuffs?
Well, we tried when we drafted the agreement to hopefully put people at ease on that front. Though the license requires compliance with the guidelines, at the same time, we have given a very long notice period. So if there's something that we find that's not compliant with the guidelines, we'll send an email to the company to let them know about it, and then they have until their next release that's at least 6 months down the road in order to be able to make the change. And as a practical matter, if anybody couldn't even meet that and needed a little extra time, we'd be happy to have a conversation with them about what can you change, what can't you change, you know, let's find a way to make it right. We don't want to be causing problems for people. We're trying to, this is not about us trying to trip people up. This is about us generously sharing the intellectual property and doing it in a way that people will enjoy.
All right. Great. Thanks for your time. Corey, anything else from back of the camera?
No, I'm kind of in over my head here with all the, you know, legal stuff and everything. I'm a typical dev, and, you know, I've never read a EULA in my life, so I don't really know what's going on.
I think, in a sense, you said it the simplest way possible, which is if you make the program work as much like Office as possible, you're going to probably be very close already to complying with the license. So really it's sort of the formality of going and accepting the license and getting enrolled in the program. But, you know, most people haven't been looking to, you know, skirt the guidelines or, you know, looking to be out there saying, how can we make it different from Office? They want to make it the same as Office because they see the goodness in that too. And so I think there's been some level of discomfort that on people in the industry's part about they recognize what a lot of work we've put into the UI this time, and they're kind of nervous about should we be using this or not, because maybe Microsoft will, you know, Johnny No Thumbs is going to show up at my door and, you know, work me over or something. And so that's, and in fact, you know, when Judy started working on this, it was so that we had something to tell people, so that we could say, yes, it's okay with us. Like, yes, we worked hard on it. Yes, we have intellectual property on it, but that that shouldn't keep you from using it for your own program. And so most developers, their tendency is going to be just to look and see how it works in the program, and they're going to try to clone that. And that's going to get you really, really close. The one thing that I don't know if we've said about the license is it's also we can't come change the terms of it later, right? Like, is that true or not true?
It's a legal agreement between us and the licensee, so no, we can't. We don't have
a
unilateral right
to
come in and change it. So,
yeah.
And it's a perpetual license. So
perpetual. It's not a bait and switch.
So people, yeah, it's not like we can terminate. We have no right to terminate the agreement unless people breach. So as long as you're compliant, you can keep distributing your application that's licensed in compliance with the guidelines. We can't say, okay, we changed our mind, now you have to stop.
Exactly, or you have to pay for it now.
Yeah.
That's, you know, so the risk is very, very low, as long as you, you know, comply with what's in the guideline document.
Yeah.
All right. So. Well, great. Thanks for your time, and we'll check back in, you know, 5 years and see how we did, if we got a consistent set of applications.
Awesome. Sounds good. So I'll see you November 15th, 2011.
Put it on the schedule. Absolutely.
Okay. Well, bye, everybody.